Presented by DogNation.com, this is Dog Nation Daily, the daily podcast for Georgia Bulldogs fans. Here's your host, Brandon Adams.
I don't know if you're like me. I've been thinking a lot about sports while we've had no sports through this coronavirus shutdown, lockdown situation. And here's the thing I've kind of discovered, and I guess I'd be curious to know if you feel the same way that I do. What I've discovered after having lived life these last couple of months without sports is that sports in our society serve a purpose that goes beyond just diversion, entertainment. Ultimately, there are things in life more important than sports. We all understand that. Yet sports themselves are more important than they appear. It's not just a distraction. It's not just a form of entertainment. In some ways, it's kind of a gathering place that unites a community together. And I think that sports does a really good job of that. I think we've felt less connected to each other without sports. The institution of sports, I think, really matters. And that means the various things inside sports also matter as well, including rivalries. I think that rivalries, you know, viewing your team as the best, your hated team as the worst, as silly as some of that kind of stuff comes across sometimes, I think that actually does a lot of good for society. And I know this is kind of like one of those moments where I become a philosophical blowhard. So stick with me just for a couple seconds and we'll get past this. You know, uniting around the red and black of Georgia against the orange and blue of Florida or the awful orange and white of Tennessee, whatever else, uniting around that stuff and against the other person sometimes may keep us from forming the same kind of tribes when it comes to politics or something like that, where the repercussions of being quite so us against them can be a lot worse. The us against them stuff in sports is actually kind of fun, and it makes us feel closer to the friends that we have who like our team, and it gives us something to cheer against, which is also pretty fun there as well. Because of that, the understanding of the fact that the rivalries of sports make it fun, in particular in the SEC, because as corny as the catchphrase can be, the fact that it just means more, because it does mean more, the rivalries themselves, Georgia versus Florida, Auburn versus Alabama, LSU versus whoever their rival of the moment is, those rivalries also take on an extra level of intensity. And because of that, because of the fact that I jump in and on social media and I have fun with these kinds of things, I have pretty thick skin about what gets said back to me. For those of you that follow me on Twitter at Dog Nation Daily, I think you would attest to this. I don't ever get in an argument with anybody. And every now and then people will send nasty things my way or whatever else. And for the most part, I ignore it. I've always found Twitter mentions fairly easy to ignore. I don't get really offended or upset about that kind of stuff at all, especially when it's kind of an us against them type of thing. Florida fans viewing me as the Georgia guy, Tennessee fans viewing me that same way. I poke enough fun. I talk enough trash on these Twitter streets that you got to have pretty thick skin on all that kind of stuff. And for the most part, I do. However, there is one thing that I notice about the commonality with the way that people kind of come at me on Twitter because of my UGA fandom, my connection here as the host of Dog Nation Daily. The one thing that I see all the time, and for those of you that also participate in the social media back and forth, I'm guessing you've probably seen a lot of this too. Well, you know, it's been 40 years since Georgia's won a national championship. Can we talk for a moment about just how silly that retort back to Georgia is by most of the people who make it? Now, listen, as a Georgia fan who's 43 years old, I don't really have memories of Georgia's national championship in 1980. I'm not old enough to really remember that. I have lived through most of my years being a Georgia fan, incredibly disappointed by seeing Georgia come up short. It hurts me as a fan, and I can't wait. Like so many of you who are about my age, who've even those of you who are a little younger than me, who've lived with that longing sense of anticipation for when Georgia eventually wins a national championship, the fact that Georgia hasn't won one, and so many of its neighboring border rival programs and states have done so. Yeah, that kind of stinks. You want to see that come to an end. You want to see Georgia correct that at some point in time, and as an aside, I guess I believe eventually that is going to happen. But I think there are two kinds of programs. I think there are those who have a right to ding Georgia for that, and those who are growing into a category that don't really have much of a right to say that anymore. If you're an LSU fan, and you don't really see a lot of Georgia versus LSU online squabbles or message board beefs, you don't see as much of that. But if an LSU fan wants to laugh at Georgia for not having won a national championship in the last 40 years, for now, until Georgia gets that done, if you're a UGA fan, I think you just sort of have to take that because LSU is the reigning champion. Clemson won the title in 2018. Clemson has used its national championship success as a bit of a cudgel recruiting against Georgia. For now, until Georgia gets a chance to play Clemson head-to-head, beat them, win its own national championship. For now, Georgia has to kind of take that. Even Alabama, who last won a national championship in 2017, clearly they've used that as a part of their national national success, as a part of their recruiting formula. Clearly, that's something that has kind of worked for them. And for now, if you're Georgia, you kind of have to take that. But if you notice what I notice on social media with Georgia fans or message board stuff or wherever fans are getting together, it's often not the recent champions or the fans of the recent champions who are saying this kind of stuff. It's not LSU fan, Clemson fan, or Alabama fan. It's Auburn fan. And here's what's weird. To the Auburn fan who may be my age, Auburn's last national championship seems fairly easy to remember. It seems like just yesterday that Auburn with Cam Newton was winning a national championship. But the truth is, that was 2010. That's 10 years ago. The constituency in college football that matters most, the recruits, the elite prospects for the class of 2021, they were 8 years old when Auburn last won a national championship. How many of those recruits have any memory of that whatsoever? My guess is very few. And what's even worse are the other programs who try to do that, because by comparison, Auburn's championship is at least fairly contemporary. Florida fans ragging on Georgia all the time about the fact that it's been since 1980 since Georgia's won a national championship, and the total number of nays that it's been. And, you know, obviously, you know, there was the thing with the spring game at Florida a couple years ago and all that kind of stuff back when we still had spring games. But the truth is, Florida's last national championship was 2008. That's 12 years ago. The elite prospects for the class of 2021 were kindergartners the last time Florida won a national championship. If you're a Gators fan who happens to be listening to me here today, if you think that the modern recruit has any connection to Florida as a national championship program, you are kidding yourself. The current recruits have no memory of that whatsoever. Florida has not been a relevant program for the most part in their lifetime. And that goes even doubly true for Tennessee. There's been a lot of Tennessee stuff on social media as of late. And every now and then, I can't resist the temptation. I'll stir the pot a little bit. And, you know, Vol Twitter lives up to its reputation every single time, firing back with a bunch of responses. And it's all 1980. It's all 40 years. But Tennessee's last national championship was 22 years ago. You know, there are parents of current recruits that may have a hard time even remembering that. Tennessee's last national championship was year one of the BCS. We're going into year six of the college football playoff. It was not in the recent past. This is a long time ago now. So I don't know who needs to hear this today, but it's probably worth a reminder that for the Florida fans and the Tennessee fans and the Auburn fans that love to rag on Georgia for how long it's been since the Dogs have won a national championship, the time that has passed since those programs have last won a national championship is increasing with every year. It is now a long time ago. With the recruits who matter most, they don't view those programs as national championship caliber, even though most of their fans were alive the last time those teams hoisted the trophy. So that particular zinger that a rival opposing fans try to throw in the direction of the Georgia Bulldogs, I'm not quite so sure it works as well as they think it does. Thanks for being with us here today on Dog Nation Daily. My name's Brandon Adams. We're good to have you with us. We're glad to have you with us, I should say. Whether you get to us radio, podcast, we are on video, of course, every morning at 10 a.m. on right now Facebook and YouTube, on our way back to Twitter very soon. And pretty soon I'm going to be able to make an announcement about Dog Nation Daily's triumphant return to our Dog Nation World Headquarters studios. Man, I can't wait to tell you more about that. That is on the way, and it's going to be really fun. Speaking of on the way, our buddy Mike Griffith on the way on our program today. We'll talk to him about some of the stuff that's been out there about when college football might be back, and is it coming back across the country? At the same time, for every place, we'll touch on some of that and a fun video that Kirby Smart has shared of the ongoing progress of the football facility at Georgia. We'll touch on some of that kind of stuff. Something else I'm going to speak about with Mike, and I'll set up for you guys right now. Professional troll Danny Cannell has proclaimed Florida the team to beat in the SEC East. Let me give you a little taste of what he said, and then I'm going to tell you why. I don't think it ought to make you very mad. Here's Danny Cannell.
The Florida Gators are the team to beat in the SEC East. I think this is the year they take that big step. I think this is the year they win the division. They've got an outstanding quarterback in Kyle Trask, who not enough people talked about this past season and the success he had with Dan Mullen. Dan Mullen is a quarterback guru. He finds talent and he develops it. Plus, you add in the wrinkle with Emory Jones, who comes in, gives you a little bit of a run threat. Florida is going to be better defensively. They have one of the best defensive coordinators in the country. But it will come down to that Georgia game, although I think too many people are plugging in Jamie Newman, the transfer from Wake Forest to Georgia, and just assuming it's going to work. I need to see it. Georgia has a bunch of issues across the offensive line that they need to fix. I don't know if Jamie Newman is going to be the next coming of Joe Burrow. I would bet against it, considering that standard that Burrow set. Florida Gators are the team to beat in the SEC East this year.
So I really like this clip. I know that's going to surprise many of you, but I do. I really like this clip. I really like it for a few reasons. I'm going to try to cram a lot into a couple minutes here. First of all, there's an element of Danny Cannell that I sort of weirdly like. And I know that may seem strange, but I'm a pro wrestling fan. I have a high tolerance for theatrics when it comes to my sporting stuff. And in pro wrestling, everybody's got a gimmick. Everybody's got a shtick. Cannell clearly has one. He's anti-SEC. Frankly, I don't think Cannell would be employed right now if he didn't have something that people knew about him. People know Cannell is an SEC hater, and that's why he's on the CBS Sports Network or whatever it is that he's talking on here. He wouldn't be on those airwaves if he didn't have some sort of shtick. His anti-SEC shtick, for the most part, works for him. I'm not really mad at him about that. But beyond that, there's another reason why I like this clip, because it illustrates something I've talked to you guys about before. But there's kind of a science to how you construct a hot take, and there are people who come up with their hot take and then work backwards to find the reasons, or there are people who do some research and some evidence, and that leads them towards a hot take. It's pretty obvious here that Cannell is illustrating my exact point about people who decide the take they want to have and then work backwards to fill in the gaps. I mean, we hear Danny Cannell say that he's sure that Florida's going to have a great defense this season. Why are you sure about that? Didn't they just lose Jonathan Grenard? Didn't they just lose Jabari Zuniga? Didn't they just lose C.J. Wilson? How are you sure that Florida is going to replace those guys without mentioning any of the names that might be replacing them, just on the basis of Todd Grantham alone? How are you sure about that? I also think it's interesting that he is sure that Georgia, he says, has some problems along the offensive line in a way that Florida apparently doesn't. Yet what does not come up in this discussion is that Florida, from an offensive line standpoint, was not very good a year ago, bringing back some of the names from that offensive line from a group that didn't really perform all that well. They were 13th in the SEC in rushing yards, for instance. How is Florida going to be good simply by being older when the group they had a year ago wasn't exactly performing all that well? You also have the comparison. He doesn't intentionally do this, but it's obvious that this comes up, of he's certain that Emory Jones is going to provide an extra wrinkle to the Florida offense coming in to occasionally spell Kyle Trask, I would imagine. Yet we haven't seen very much of Emory Jones doing this in a Florida uniform. Yet the sight unseen status of Jamie Newman is a negative against him. This is the classic example of something I tell you all the time. Be very careful. And even sometimes this is the pro Georgia stuff too. Be very careful about people who construct hot takes on the basis of very little evidence. In Cannell's case, a classic example of him doing that. He decides the point he wants to make. The anti-SEC troll wants to take down one of the SEC big boys, touting Florida as a way to do that. Yet the actual substance of the argument, for the most part, is lacking. I think that's very, very telling. And for those of you that like to kind of pay attention to some of the hot take stuff that's out there, notice how vapid some of the reasons for some of these hot takes would occasionally be. But beyond that, the real reason why I like the take from Cannell here is it sets up something else that we've talked about here on this program. It makes a potential Georgia win over Florida all the much sweeter this year for all the reasons that Cannell just cites. Dan Mullen is the offensive guru. He's got the returning quarterback, Kyle Trask. Georgia, as a UGA hater would say, had to go to Wake Forest to drag a transfer quarterback who occasionally wasn't very good in some of the games the Demon Deacons played a year ago. Georgia's offense, such a failure, they had to go desperate and find Todd Monken to come in here and orchestrate some sort of transformation. But as I've told you before, what if Monken does execute that transformation? And what if Jamie Newman does thrive in the Todd Monken offense? Now, I don't even think the Joe Burrow comparison is a fair one because of how good Burrow was a year ago. But you don't have to be as good as Joe Burrow to be very good for UGA. What if Jamie Newman is simply better than Kyle Trask? What if the Georgia offense is simply better than what Florida is able to put together this season under offensive guru Dan Mullen? And that's been the ultimate talking point for Gators fans for why they think their program will eventually topple Georgia. They believe that Dan Mullen's the better coach, despite the evidence of success coaching against Kirby Smart. But nonetheless, that's the fact, or the appearance of a fact, that Florida fans like to hang their hat on. But if it doesn't happen this year, with a returning quarterback who admittedly played pretty well a year ago in Kyle Trask, and Georgia having a quarterback on its roster that most of us hadn't heard of until a few months ago, if it doesn't happen this year, and if the Georgia offense outperforms the Florida, then at that point in time, what will Gators fans say about their coach? I think they may get pretty restless, which will be another fun thing for Georgia fans to watch. We appreciate you being here on Dog Nation Daily today. Speaking of some fun, let's have some of that with Mike Griffith here, and a whole lot more after that, right here on Dog Nation Daily.
From Athens and across the SEC or wherever the recruiting trail may lead, here's a DogNation.com insider.
Mike, thanks for being with us here today on video and on podcast and radio as well. We appreciate your time.
Yeah, I had to rest my fingers, BA. Those Florida fans, they found me. They moved on from you to me. They're coming after me on Twitter today.
Well, listen, they are a mess indeed, and a lot of other rival fan bases right there with them. So always a lot of fun. Let me talk about something else for a minute, though, that might not be quite as much fun, but it is at least interesting. What college football is going to look like when it returns this fall. Now, a couple caveats here. I'm going to try to cram as much information into a short period of time as we can. And I'm going to try to tiptoe around what is obviously by the day seemingly becoming a more political story. We're allergic to politics on this show, but there's an element of this. It's becoming greatly politically polarized, it would seem. So we'll try to steer clear of that. Mike, here's what I think is interesting right now. You have the national radio host Colin Cowherd come out yesterday saying that he believes that Alabama-USC, one of those marquee week one games, is now not going to take place. Paul Feinbaum, I believe, was on ESPN this week saying that Alabama was even looking at an alternative opponent for that game. Maybe it's TCU, who's also scheduled to open the season by playing a Pac-12 team in Cal. So clearly, there's a growing belief that in the far west, the Pac-12, the state of California in particular, they may not be ready for college football come week one. And that runs concurrent to most of SEC country, good number of the Midwest, Big Ten included. I would say the Big 12 very much in this conversation. Those conferences, those schools seemingly getting ready for the season to start as normal. So let me just lob a question to you that'll start a conversation with us today. How do we navigate a situation where one of the Power Five leagues seems to be going in a dramatically different direction than the rest of the country when it comes to football's eventual return?
Yeah, you know, and it all stems from the Los Angeles mayor saying that they're not going to have social gatherings for quite a while. So how does USC get prepared for that opening game in Arlington, Texas? And TCU becomes the natural fit because they're already right there in Fort Worth. And as you mentioned, have a Pac-12 team. Well, how do you prepare? You got to let it play out. I mean, what's starting to happen, though, BA, is we're starting to hear, as you said, the politics. People are politicking. There's a reason that those Pac-12 coaches held a teleconference and started trying to negotiate for a uniform start for practice preparation, for conference games only. They're doing everything they can to save their season and buy time. They are hoping that college football can be delayed probably a month and go conference games only, because I'm starting to believe that maybe that's the only way we have all of the Pac-12 schools playing college football, is if we delay the start of the season. And then the question becomes, if everybody else is ready to go, do they hold up the start of the season because there's four college teams in California?
And that last part I think is really interesting, and here's what I believe about that. When it comes to delaying the start of the season, I think the Pac-12 will have some leverage there. Greg Sankey was on the SEC Network this week saying that there's never been more communication and cooperation with Power Five conference commissioners than there is right now. That lets me know that the Pac-12's relationship within the college football playoff, the coalition that puts that together, they have some leverage, because when it comes to future negotiations in terms of expanding day teams or whatever else, the Pac-12, and primarily its relationship with the Rose Bowl, gives it some leverage in terms of not being completely moved on without. However, Mike, I don't believe for the Pac-12 that's infinite leverage. If the Pac-12 and the states that make it up are so willing to draw a hard line in the sand about we're not coming back, we're not ready to do this yet, then I think at that point in time, the SEC, I would say the Big 12 and the Big 10, the ACC is a little bit different because it's not really a geographic conference, but the other conferences at that point in time would have no choice to move on. And the fact of the matter is, for a long number of years, the NFL operated without California. There were no Rams, no Raiders in that state, or at least there was no Rams. The Rams left there for a while in Los Angeles. You know, for the most part, you have sports like hockey, you have lacrosse. They're not national sports. They're very regional. You know, lacrosse is played in the mid-Atlantic states. Hockey's played in the far north. The idea that college football can't be played unless it's played equally nationally, a lot of the sports that are NCAA sanctioned don't necessarily operate that way. If college football needs to move on from California, and if California won't cooperate, eventually that's kind of what will happen.
Yeah, and Mark Emmert has said that he's not going to mandate a uniform start date. So if the SEC schools are ready to report back in July, which I think they will be, and do the whole quarantine thing with the coaches and the testing and the tracing and the treatment, those three buzzwords, I believe they'll move forward. And BA, I would go as far as to say that college football could start in September and maybe the Pac-12 starts in October, but you keep them in the college football playoff mix. Maybe they get rid of all of their non-conference game and they start a month later. But I think money is going to determine, first of all, safety, right? But then secondly, money. What does television want? I do not think television is going to go a month without college football in September. Yep. Unless it absolutely has to. And it's possible that the Pac-12 just doesn't come to the table until October and plays conference games only.
I'll also give you my final prediction on this, then we'll move on and talk about something different. Eventually, some of the governments far out west that have drawn these really stark lines, I think eventually they'll soften their stance. Much the same way that the dominoes toppled for sports going away, I think the dominoes toppling for sports return will kind of be the same thing, where eventually it's going to be hard to be the final lone holdout. That's my prediction on that, but I'll give you the last word on this topic.
Well, I think it's difficult to be the last holdout because the transfer portal fills up and those kids will find places to play. And if you're the NCAA, how can you say no to them if they say, I want out of USC or I want out of UCLA or I want out of Stanford because I want to play college football and they're not allowing me to do. Can you imagine, BA, if you're a college student and they take your major away? I'm trying to major in engineering. I'm a third-year student, and they eliminate my program and say I can't go to class. I'm out of there, man. So the Pac-12 has got to get on board, or they're going to lose their students, and there may not be a recovery for those schools.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. Let me move on and talk about something more fun for a moment. I know you wrote yesterday about what the analyst Danny Cannell said about Florida winning the SEC East. My take on this is going to surprise you a little bit. I actually don't dislike Danny Cannell all that much. I'm a pro wrestling fan. I have a high tolerance for theater when it comes to how you carry yourself. I like shtick. I like gimmicks. Cannell's gimmick of being the anti-SEC guy has worked for him. He's more famous for being anti-SEC than he would be if he was more down the middle, calling it, you know, even. He's become more famous, you know, this way. So the fact that sort of arguing against Georgia is the way that you show an anti-SEC bias, in a weird way, I think that says something pretty good about UGA, that they've become established enough that the anti-SEC guy, the SEC hater, now feels the need to argue for someone else. Just kind of shows you, I would say, the strength of the Georgia program and what's been established here over the course of the last couple of years. If Cannell is making a case against Georgia, my assumption is Georgia must be doing something right.
Well, two things here. The irony of Florida State graduate pulling for a rival Florida in-state is interesting. And secondly, the ACC guy saying that he doesn't believe in Jamie Newman, a guy who did some pretty impressive things at Wake Forest before he lost his top two receivers. You know, I see all these numbers and everybody's shooting holes in Jamie Newman because his numbers weren't this against winning teams or weren't that at the end of the year. And everyone forgets he lost two of his top three receivers the final four games of the season. The offense changed entirely. It's almost like evaluating Jake Fromm without Lawrence Cager on the field 78%, Cager off the field 52%. It matters who you're throwing to. Ask Steve Young. He was a nobody with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and a Hall of Famer with the 49ers.
Well, I guess my take on Newman, though, is slightly different. I've said before that given the transfers that Georgia could have taken, I think that Newman's probably about the best available that you could have gone out and gotten. Given the other uncertainties at the SEC this season in terms of quarterback situations, Georgia's not that much different from LSU, who doesn't know much about Miles Brennan. Alabama, who wants to hold a quarterback competition between Bryce Young and Mac Jones. Tennessee, who I think has very little idea of who its starting quarterback is going to be. Georgia's not all that different from those other programs. Even Florida, who has an established starter in Kyle Trask, I think wants an expanded role for Emory Jones, and that's uncertain given the fact the Gators, like everybody else, had no spring practice. So I'll say those things for the positive about Newman. But I'm happy to say I have no idea ultimately how good he's going to be. I'm not going to absolve away some of the issues he may have had at Wake Forest because he was missing receivers. That I wasn't watching those games for the full 60 minutes. I'm not going to explain all that away. I don't quite know how good Jamie Newman's going to be. I don't mind people questioning him. Frankly, Mike, I don't mind people questioning the Georgia offense either. I think there are some big changes that have to take place over the course of the season for Georgia to be better than it has been the last couple of years. So I don't mind the criticism of the offense. I don't mind the skepticism of Newman because I've seen the opposite too many times where a quarterback came in the SEC, highly touted, huge expectations, and sometimes those guys don't live up to it. So I'm not turned off necessarily by skepticism of Newman, outright questioning of the Georgia offense. I think all of that is fair in terms of a preseason conversation. And I say that as someone who obviously wants the best for the Georgia offense eventually.
Yeah, and the good news is they don't have to be great because you've got the best defense in the country returning, and that's what nobody wants to talk about or acknowledge. You know, that was missing from Danny Cannell's logic. I mean, you've got to remember the Florida Gators had all of 3 points after three quarters. They had negative rushing yards. At 175 total yards through three quarters in last year's game. If I'm not mistaken, they lose their running back. I mean, I could sit here and shoot holes in Florida. I can shoot holes in Tennessee. I can shoot holes in just about any team. Every team has questions that had guys drafted, including Georgia. The one common returning element in the SEC is that Georgia defense. That is far and away the best group returning on offense or defense, maybe in the nation. You've got 9 of 11 guys back off a defense that played against Baylor and shut them out for a half. And frankly, ranked in the top 10 in every major category, 8th in pass efficiency defense, 3rd in total defense, number 1 in the nation in run defense, and number 1 in scoring defense. And you got 9-11 guys back. So I don't know why nobody wants to talk about that, but I'm sure Kirby Smart is just fine with that. Because if you remember, BA, when I asked him earlier this spring for 5 guys that stood out in the offseason workouts, he managed to give us 5 guys, and none of them were on defense. So that tells you where Kirby Smart is raising the bar on those guys.
Let me ask you a direct question here for a moment. If we stipulate that the Georgia defense will be, we'll just say, matching what it did last season, very stingy when it comes to yards allowed, very stingy when it comes to points allowed, that it plays similarly to the way that it did a year ago, how much better do you think the offense needs to be?
I don't know that it needs to be better at all. It needs to avoid games where you have 4 turnovers and 2 missed field goals because that will get you beat against anybody in the SEC, and that's what happened against South Carolina. But if the Georgia defense is on par with where they were last year and the offense is efficient, which you know, Kirby, they're going to win the SEC. And part of it is because of COVID-19 and the restrictions because these other offenses, they don't have time to get in sync. And that's going to put defenses ahead of offense early in the season. Really plays into Georgia's favor when they play Alabama on September 19th.
Yeah, I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, the Alabama game notwithstanding, I do think the defense plays a bigger role in that game than we've kind of seen, you know, some of the high-profile SEC games in recent years. But I'm a big believer that if you keep doing what you've always done, you'll keep getting what you've always had. What we've had from Georgia the last few years is an offense that was not national championship caliber, whether it's not scoring any points in the fourth quarter of Alabama in the SEC championship game in 2018, not scoring any points in the second half against Alabama in the national championship game of 2017, or obviously, you know, an offense that sputtered in a lot more than just the South Carolina game a year ago. If the offense for Georgia is not better in 2020, Mike, this team's not winning the national championship or the SEC championship, either one.
Well, I mean, they've certainly got to be better than they were at times last year, BA. But again, if they can avoid the turnovers and be efficient running the ball, I think they've got a chance to win big. I don't think they need to have an offense like LSU's or Alabama's to win a championship. Now, it worked for LSU last year. They were dynamic. They had experienced receivers coming back. They had a pro quarterback who didn't have to go to class, a second-year grad student who was able to do nothing but focus on football. They had, 16 guys that went to the – that was an incredibly talented – great achievement for LSU. They were working on it last summer. Give those guys credit. That was a magical season and everybody was on board. I don't think there's going to be any magic for anyone this year. This is a grind. This is hard. Student athletes are having to manage themselves and teams are going to have to cobble things together quickly. And I like Kirby Smart's odds in that scenario because of this great defense.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm not saying you have to be as good as LSU was a season ago. I don't know if that's even possible for anyone, but better than Georgia has been. I think that's obvious. Otherwise, Todd Monken wouldn't be here. By the way, tonight on the Dog Nation video channels, fun continues as Jeff Sintel hosts Before the Hedges presented by Kroger. A great look at the scene for UGA recruiting. As I told you on yesterday's show, really heating up with some 5-star guys getting ready to eliminate some names and come out with a list of finalists or outright make their pledge. a lot of that on the horizon over the course of the next few weeks for UGA. And Jeff Sintel is covering it all as a part of Before the Hedges presented by Kroger. And by the way, speaking of our friends at Kroger, making the shopping experience even more enjoyable during this COVID-19 weird situation where supermarkets have been a lot more top of mind for all of us. You know, every time I go into the Kroger near me, the shelves have been stocked, the store has been clean, the staff has been taking great care to make sure that everyone has peace of mind about their shopping experience, maintain some social distance, and just an overall sense of hygiene, feeling good about the situation. And now Kroger's taking that a step further as well, offering free pickup. They'll let you shop online, place your order, you show up in the parking lot, the Kroger folks come out and deliver the stuff very safely and sensibly right there to your car. It's another way that which Kroger is taking care of you during this coronavirus time, and we send a huge, huge thank you out to them. Mike, it was fun to see on video, and I think for our video audience will show this, the work continuing in the Georgia football facility. It's kind of crammed right in there in between the track and the Butts Meyer Heritage Hall and the practice facility and the indoor practice facility. It's almost like building a skyscraper in New York City in terms of the very small footprint they're putting this thing on. But the work continues on that, which in a way, I guess, is symbolic that the business of trying to build a college football program doesn't stop, even with everyone off campus right now. Nice to see Kirby Smart sharing that on social media this week. And nice to think that the building and what everything that it symbolizes and hopefully will bring with it in terms of the football future for UGA, that's all continuing as well.
Yeah, it's good to see George getting up to par with the football building, $81 million building. I believe about three or four stories, BA. And, you know, that building's supposed to be done by next January, and then they're going to connect it to the rest of Butts Meyer Heritage Hall. So McGarity told me on the front end the construction would continue, and this is where George's relatively conservative nature, that $105 million available in the emergency fund, this is where you got to be thankful. This is where Georgia separates. And if you're a student athlete, this is where a Georgia scholarship is worth more than other places. Because while other programs are shutting down or furloughing coaches or making sacrifices in different departments, Georgia is full steam ahead at the moment because of that reserve fund. They have not overloaded themselves with debt. They have not taken on projects that they couldn't fund. A lot of this, again, you got to give credit to Greg McGarity and the way that they've managed the money. That's why Georgia is full steam ahead. And as for getting up to par, some people might say, what are you talking about? 24/7 last year did a survey on all the facilities. Georgia's football facilities, BA, only ranked 8. I think this football building is going to elevate Georgia to be on par with Clemson, with LSU, and Alabama, and their recruiting can get even better because it can never get good enough.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about the emergency fund before, and you've reported on this. In your reporting, I guess the one thing that's never been clear to me is, does Georgia have any plans to use this emergency fund? And if so, how would they use it? But that's the one thing in all of this. I guess I've certainly heard a lot over the years of the emergency fund that's been collected, even predating Greg McGarity's time as athletic director. But in terms of actually using it, I guess I'm not clear of how UGA would use it, or in the event, you know, budget crisis become a big issue, if Georgia's going to use it at all.
Yeah, I think you're going to see it used more for these non-revenue facilities. The McGill Society has just done an unbelievable job. I mean, there's a before and an after with the McGill Society and Georgia money. And since the McGill Society has come to the table, that's what's enabled these plans and Georgia football and Kirby Smart to move forward. It's kind of happening. The McGill Society, Kirby, they've kind of taken flight at the same time. And so from what I understand, talking to Greg McGarity, a lot of that reserve money we talk about, you know, you look at Specktown's track. I mean, listen, do you know Georgia has a national championship caliber track program? You wouldn't know that going by the track. Now, it's nice and cute and wonderful, but it does not compete with other track facilities. And if Georgia wants to maintain a championship track program like they have, they're going to have to do something there. They don't have an indoor track facility. If you take a look around, I know they just did some things with the tennis court. Foley Field, what are you going to do about that? I mean, they're selling it out, but it could be, should be so much bigger. Is that something that Georgia takes a look at? Maybe an off-campus baseball stadium that holds several thousand people instead of just a few thousand. So Georgia's moving forward, but they're doing so in a very responsible fashion. But again, the McGill Society coming to the table and essentially bankrolling football is what's enabling some of that emergency fund money to start getting spread out in some of these areas where Georgia needs to grow with their non-revenue sports.
My quick final thought from me, the Zach Evans saga came to an end this week. He's at TCU. You got a thought on that?
Well, I mean, I'm glad for the kid. I mean, he's getting to stay closer to home. You know, I think Gary Patterson's kind of a disciplinarian. That's my take on Gary. I covered him in a bowl game down there when Michigan State played him. I'm familiar with what he's done. TCU has been a very impressive transition into the Big 12. I know they've had a little bit of a dip the last few years. I think it's good for TCU. I think it's good for the kid. Now it's just a matter of managing him and seeing how he fits in the program. Obviously, they've got a rich tradition there. I believe Kenneth Davis was there, as well as LaDainian Tomlinson. So TCU is a tradition-rich program for running backs. He's staying closer to home. And I think Georgia moved on from him a long time ago. But I do realize that he was a fascinating recruit, and there was a lot of interest in him.
Mike, we appreciate your time here on Dog Nation Daily today. We'll look forward to reading from you at dognation.com and catching up with you back here again on our program very soon as well.
Thanks, BA.
Let's take a look around the rest of the league. This is SEC Through.
As we transition to our SEC Through, I want to talk a little bit more about some of the stuff that I was chatting with Mike about college football's eventual return, and does it come back at the same time all across the country? And there's a lot out there about that. And I guess as I think about the decision that's about to be made, I think there's something important to keep in mind. If you go back and watch a lot of those documentaries, remember during the season they were celebrating 150 years of college football, so there were a lot of retrospectives on what college football has looked like over the last 150 years. And I came of age as a college football fan as a child in the 80s, and in that era and the era predating me in the 70s, it's always kind of amazing. A lot of the documentary stuff that you saw back during the season, I thought, did a pretty good job of illustrating this. It was always amazing how comfortable the powers that be in college football were at the time with really no national champion. I mean, the sport crowned a champion based on the voting of the Associated Press and the United Press International, the other news agency at the time. So we voted on a national champion, the writers did, but it wasn't really decided on the field, and it was always controversial. And for the most part, the powers that be in college football didn't really care because the bowl system was really profitable. I also think the coaches were fine with that system too, because claiming they were the best in their region and never really having to go to a college football playoff and meet the other best teams from the other regions gave a lot of job security to a lot of coaches for a long time, so they were kind of okay with it. But the bowl system for the university presidents and the athletic directors was really, really profitable. The reason why I tell you that is because you fast forward all those years later, when we get to the time of post-BCS looking at a college football playoff, the Pac-12 wasn't always necessarily a willing participant in this process because they, I think, felt like they had a pretty good deal with their regular connection to the Rose Bowl, because for as profitable as the bowl system has been for a long time, really, you know, no bowl's more profitable than the Rose Bowl. You know, big time placement on New Year's Day, obviously a huge television audience. The parade has always been really weirdly a big deal for the people associated with the Tournament of Roses and the folks in California. Georgia fans will remember that back from 2017. So the Pac-12 had to be convinced to be a part of the college football playoff equation. And when you think about all these weird things associated with the playoff, almost all of it's related to the Rose Bowl. Why were the games on New Year's Eve a few years ago? Why have they been on, like, say, December 27th? Stuff like that. Because the Rose Bowl wants to maintain its spot on New Year's Day, and when it's not a playoff game, the other bowls kind of get displaced. Now, all of that is to say this. That demonstrates the leverage the Pac-12 has had. So when you hear stories about how L.A. is going to be locked down forever, and that may slow the return of college football there, and Pac-12 coaches have come together, united, to say, we want a uniform start to college football across the country. At first blush, it can be easy to completely disregard that because, as I've even tweeted, you know, college football can exist without California, can exist without the Pac-12. But I do think Commissioner Greg Sankey around the SEC, the Big Ten, the other big money league in the sport, I think they'll be at least a little bit willing to listen to the Pac-12, and the Pac-12 will have at least a little bit of leverage in these discussions because of the fact that future playoff negotiations, they want to maintain the Pac-12 status as a willing partner in all of that. I don't think it's infinite leverage at a certain point in time if the Pac-12 and the politicians in those Pac-12 states are drawing a really hard line in the sand, then eventually the Midwest, the South, the Southwest will just move on without the Pac-12. It won't be that hard to do. But that's not a best-case scenario, and that's one of the reasons why I think you've heard SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey come out this week and say there's been more discussion, more cooperation with these league commissioners than you've seen in the past, because ultimately they are a part of that playoff coalition together, and that's something that's very profitable for the sport. And Big Ten commissioner, SEC commissioner, Big 12 commissioner would like to try to hold that group together if at all possible. My prediction here is once the politicians in the Pac-12 states have gotten credit for taking the coronavirus the most seriously, they're going to fall in line and do what everybody else is doing. I don't think you can be the lone holdout to sports, nor do I think you can be the lone holdout when it comes to economic activity either. I mean, really, this is a tough subject to only do headline surfing on. Headlines across the various news sites will leave you with one opinion when actually reading the news about what's going on around the country, I think will lead you to a different perspective. The truth is, for as dramatically different as some states have been talked about, and as dramatically different as the press conferences for various governors have been, the truth is, the actual behaviors of the states across the country, and you can do the research on this yourself, they're not necessarily all that different. There's more similarities in state behavior than you might otherwise think. I mean, for instance, think about, you know, the fact that, you know, Florida got dinged for some of its beaches opening, but the National Mall has been open in Washington, D.C. There are some parks even open in New York City. You know, Georgia's opened up, kind of gotten some criticism for that, but very quietly right next to that, Colorado's kind of done some of the same things, and it seemingly hasn't gotten as much attention. There's a way in which, when you talk about some of this stuff in terms of who's coming back and when, how they impact sports, it eventually gets a little bit political. I hate that kind of stuff. For this show, we stay away from that. But at a certain point, you can't deny the moving tide of which sports are coming back, which sports aren't, which states are tolerant of the idea of sports and which aren't. If you care about college football, at a certain point, you got to start paying a little bit of attention to that. And so that's out there right now. As we wrap up here today, I'll remind you, Gator Hater Update are now been 1,292 days since those lousy, stinking Gators beating the Georgia Bulldogs. That's good news. And by the way, you want to stay up to date on what's happening in the coronavirus in our state? Check out AJC.com for more on that. We'll see you back here again tomorrow.